individuals in everyday life. We now present you an article written by Nadine Naber. The piece is titled, 20 Years After Patriot Act, Surveillance of Arabs and Muslims is Relentless. The United States is now more than 20 years beyond the Patriot Act of October 2001. The immediate aftermath of 9/11 brought a heavy U.S. state focus on Arabs and Muslims in the United States, rationalizing an expansion of policing and surveillance activities against them. It also inspired the convergence of shared struggles for liberation out of a growing consensus that we cannot abolish policing without abolishing U.S. militarism and empire building. The anything-goes context of 9/11 opened up possibilities for expanded forms of policing and surveillance that are unconstitutional. The National Security Entry-Exit Registration System, or NSEERS, also known as Special Registration, put in place by the Department of Justice in 2002, targeted Arabs and Muslims as well as those from West Asia and South Asia. Overly broad interpretations of material support laws denied people, generally Arabs and Muslims, their freedom and even threatened some forms of humanitarian aid. But none of this was entirely new. All this was preceded by President Richard Nixon's Operation Boulder, which law professor Susan Akram has described as perhaps the first concerted U.S. government effort to target Arabs in the United States for special investigation with the specific purpose of intimidation, harassment, and to discourage their activism on issues relating to West Asia. Ironically, Timothy McVeigh's 1995 Oklahoma City attack opened the door to the Clinton administration pushing forward a legislative effort allowing the government to use evidence from secret sources in deportation proceedings for aliens suspected of terrorist involvement. The New York Times reported under the measure, the government would not have to disclose the source of the damaging information to the person whom it is seeking to deport. A white extremist then had carried out a deadly bombing, but it was Arabs and Muslims, including black Arabs and black Muslims, who faced the prospect of deportation without ever being able to confront their accuser, or even know the identity of those accusing them. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act established a new court charged only with hearing cases in which the government seeks to deport aliens accused of engaging in terrorist activities based on secret evidence submitted in the form of classified information. The 1996 Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Responsibility Act expanded the secret evidence court so that secret evidence could be more easily used to deport even lawful permanent residents as terrorists. As Arab and Muslim communities were subjected to institutionalized racial profiling, this too frequently encouraged individual anti-Arab and Islamophobic actors who further intimidated and committed acts of violence against Arab and Muslim individuals in everyday life. Between 2000 and 2009, these violent incidents increased by over 500%. Since 2016, 484 incidents of hate-motivated violence have been reported and many continue to remain unreported. In West Asia, North African and South Asian regions, of course, The U.S. military killed people en masse while engaging in torture. The U.S. government also supported authoritarian dictators like Egypt's Hosni Mubarak, who would further the U.S. imperialist agenda and simultaneously collaborate in the ongoing colonization of Palestine and the siege of the Gaza Strip. According to the Project on Government Oversight's Jake LaPerouque, the U.S., in its rush to crack down on these domestic communities, swept up international communications on an enormous and unprecedented scale. LaPerouque also notes that internal U.S. communications were surveyed, and as were internet metadata. When eventually disclosed, this surveillance troubled and infuriated people across the political spectrum, some who cared about ending racial profiling of Arabs and Muslims, and some who generally had spent years inflaming such hatred. Many strands of society were incensed that their communications were being monitored by the government, yet those with history in US-based Global South liberation movements, who were targeted by programs like Nixon's counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, or those whose ancestors were killed via collaborations between the Ku Klux Klan, KKK, and the FBI, knew all too well that the Constitution was meant to protect white supremacy rather than protecting all Americans. The George W. Bush administration had effectively circumvented the Fourth Amendment with its protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. Attempts to override the entirely bankrupt legislative action of the USA Freedom Act of 2015 was a consequence less out of concern over targeting Muslims and Arabs than anger over the widespread sweeping up of so much information about US citizens. Read, white people. I lived through these past 20 years between communities in California, Illinois, and Michigan. The fear was very real. While working-class Arab Muslim immigrant men over the age of 16 were forced to register at their local Immigration and Naturalization Service office as part of the NSEERS program, their loved ones stood outside wondering if they would ever see them again. The reports of violence against Arabs and Muslims and those perceived to belong to those categories were terrifyingly routine. Some stories reached the mainstream media, most circulated simply through word of mouth. Now, in 2021, following the defeat of former President Donald Trump and his open promotion of anti-Muslim policies, we are witnessing the culmination of efforts led by Muslims and Arabs in the United States to build community-based power beyond the psychological and emotional incarceration endured between the Bush and Trump years. The Arab Resource and Organizing Center in California's Bay Area, along with the Arab American Action Network in Chicago, Illinois, have for years fought back in coalition to support anti-imperialist and abolitionist principles. Arabs and Muslim movements are affirming that just because Donald Trump is out doesn't mean these efforts will relent under President Joe Biden, especially not with his interventionist history and long years of support for Israel's colonial policies that have been killing, containing, and displacing Palestinians with American weaponry. These organizations recognize that U.S. empire building connects movements fighting anti-black police violence, those pressing back against anti-Arab U.S. militarism and the war on terror, as well as groups resisting the militarization of the border and the ongoing colonization of native lands. shortly after 9/11, I remember the national coalitions like Racial Justice 9/11 that grew overnight when tens of social movements affirmed their unity in the face of the expanding powers of the U.S. nation state. Today, similar coalitions are inspired by the shared concern over the ways U.S. counterinsurgency tactics that repress movements have expanded, violently justifying the repression of blacks, indigenous peoples, and the people of color, and groups like the Movement for Black Lives. When the Bush administration consolidated its internal war on Arabs and Muslims with the Patriot Act, it helped show Donald Trump the power to move a portion of the U.S. public towards increasingly outward-facing white supremacy. Yet, it also set in motion new coalitions. These coalitions have urgently grown out of the imperialist and racist policies implemented first by President George W. Bush, and then even more by Donald J. Trump.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A new report by The Times has revealed detail about one of the largest civilian casualty incidents in U.S. history. On 18th of March 2019, the U.S. military carried out an attack in the town of Baghouz in eastern Syria. An F-15E attack jet targeted a crowd of people in Baghouz with a 500-pound bomb. 5 minutes later, it dropped another even bigger bomb, and then another. Initial battle damage assessments put the death toll at around 70. The Times also revealed that following this strike, the U.S.-led coalition forces had bulldozed the blast site to cover up the incident. The U.S. military didn't publicly acknowledge the incident, and the death toll was downplayed. Finally, this week, U.S. Central Command acknowledged the attacks for the first time. It said 80 people were killed in the airstrike, including 16 Daesh terrorists and 4 civilians. However, saying it was not clear if the other 60 were civilians, it justified the killings by saying women and children might have been Daesh members. The report says the death toll was almost immediately apparent to the military officials. It said an Air Force lawyer present in the operation center at the time believed the attacks were possible war crimes, but regulations for investigating the potential crime were not followed.
Well, you know, in an ideal world, there would be a prosecution, there would be a trial and a proper hearing, but the way the world is run today, it's highly unlikely that the United States will, first of all, recognize any international court, and second of all, follow the judgment of such a court.
The admission was rather unusual, as more often civilian deaths are undercounted by the U.S. military, even in classified reports. Pentagon recently admitted that a drone strike in the Afghan capital Kabul on August 29th was a botched strike. It killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. The attack came amid the hasty withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan and days after a suicide bombing in Kabul International Airport that killed over 150 Afghans, as well as 13 U.S. service members. New research from a London-based civilian harm monitoring group named Air Wars showed that since 2001, at least 22,679 civilians were killed in U.S. strikes across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan. The group said that the number of civilian deaths could be potentially as high as over 48,300.
Well, the fact is that if the world's so-called sole superpower can flex its muscles anywhere it chooses, regardless of the United Nations, regardless of international law, and regardless of public opinion worldwide, this gives the worst possible example to American allies, and that is follow the leader. If the United States can kill people at whim, at any place, at any time, then presumably its allies can do similar things.
Pakistan, in particular, has been the victim of U.S. drone strikes. The U.S. began its attacks in 2004 to kill Al-Qaeda and Taliban forces. There are questions about how many civilians have been killed as a result of these strikes. According to the highest estimates, these strikes have killed thousands of people. The U.S. military, from CENTCOM to the Department of Defense, does not provide official estimates of civilian deaths, nor have they published such findings. Nearly 1,000 strikes hit targets in Syria and Iraq in 2019 using 4,729 bombs and missiles. The official military tally of civilian death for that entire year is only 22, and the strikes from March 18 are nowhere on the list. The strategic province of Ma'arib has for some time been a flashpoint of conflict between the Yemeni army and Ansarullah fighters on the one side and the mercenary forces supported by Saudi Arabia and the UAE on the other. Yemeni forces have been inching closer to fully liberating the province. Meanwhile, the leader of Al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen, Khaled Said Batarfi, confessed that the group's terrorists have fought against the Yemeni army and fighters from the popular Ansarullah resistance movement. He said Al-Qaeda terrorists have fought on 11 fronts. Yemen's interior ministry confirmed that the Al-Qaeda terrorists are fighting alongside Saudi-backed militants in Ma'arib, as Yemeni forces are pressing ahead with an offensive to liberate the city. However, Riyadh had denied such cooperation. The Saudi-led alliance had previously claimed it has crushed Al-Qaeda's ability to carry out attacks from Yemen. But in 2018, an investigation by the Associated Press found that the coalition has been paying some Al-Qaeda commanders to leave key cities and towns while letting others retreat with weapons, equipment, and looted cash. According to the report, hundreds of Al-Qaeda members were recruited to join the coalition as soldiers.
The United States and Saudi Arabia created terrorism, beginning with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and then moving these people that have been trained by the Central Intelligence Agency and the Saudis, and with the help of Pakistan, to the Balkans, to Yugoslavia, destroying that country. And then again, they were rebranded when they moved into Libya and Iraq and Syria as ISIS or IS or Daesh.
The report also revealed that the United States was aware of the arrangements and prevented drone attacks against the terrorists. Add to it Washington's logistical and weapons support for the Saudi-led coalition. This confirms that the U.S. is on the same side as the Saudi-led coalition and Al-Qaeda terrorists. A CNN investigation in 2019 found that Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners have transferred American-made weapons to Al-Qaeda-linked fighters and other terrorist groups waging war in Yemen. They used the weapons as a currency to buy the terrorists' loyalty. The U.S. itself is also responsible for continually sending deadly weapons to the West Asia region. Washington is also responsible for providing them with heavy weapons. The program was a total failure and only contributed to the growth of the Daesh terrorist group and the humanitarian disasters stretching across Europe. Washington is also responsible for the creation of the Daesh terrorist group. It's also accused of transferring Daesh terrorists from Iraq to Afghanistan before its shambolic withdrawal from the country.
I would certainly think so. I mean, the United States loses weapons. That's beyond belief. I think it's a way of saying, well, we either drop them to the Al-Qaeda people in the peninsula, or we gave them to the Saudis and the Emiratis to pass on to Al-Qaeda in the peninsula. So it's basically hypocrisy, which the Americans are very good at. I think they learned it from the British. But certainly, these things don't go missing. They're provided, and they're handed over. The Americans are operating in Yemen themselves, although this doesn't seem to make the Washington Post. So you're right that this is collusion and it's cooperation.
U.S. and its allies have flooded the region with weapons that have ended up in the hands of terrorists. This support for terrorists has fueled a conflict that has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians and children.
Tensions between Russia and the U.S. are on the rise again. On Friday, Moscow said it detected 6 NATO reconnaissance flights over the Black Sea over the span of 24 hours, reiterating its warning that it will defend itself against any threats along its borders. The Black Sea is a sensitive security zone for Moscow, as it's located near the Crimean Peninsula, which was reunited with Russia from Ukraine in a referendum in 2014, a move that the West deems illegal.
2014 was a defining moment. Russia stood up for itself like it stood up in 2015 in Damascus across Syria. And this is what's of most concern to Washington in this search for a unipolar world, that Russia would have the audacity, the courage to stand up for itself.
NATO has recently ramped up activities in the form of holding drills and deployment of warships in the strategic region, in a move expected to provoke a response from Russia along its western borders. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov described on Friday as provocative the increasing NATO's activities in the Black Sea and the presence of Western spy planes in the region.
I mean, Russia doesn't have anywhere close to the amount of U.S. military, the bases that the U.S. has surrounding Russia. Imagine if Russia had bases in Mexico and Canada and in the Pacific. The U.S. would never stand for that. So what we see on full display here is U.S. hypocrisy in the same Russophobic attitude that has characterized U.S. foreign policy for how many decades now.
The Russian Defense Ministry said on Tuesday that the United States was setting up a multinational group of armed forces close to Russia's border in the Black Sea region. The Kremlin has dismissed a Western media report that said the U.S. was concerned about a possible Russian attack on Ukraine, noting that Russia has posed no threats to any country.
And of course, the U.S. acting through NATO with its junior allies, constantly building up troops in Latvia, in Estonia, in Poland, across Russia's borders. So it's the Russians that have every right to be concerned.
In the meantime, the migrant crisis at the border between Belarus and Poland is also spiraling into another regional dispute involving the West at Russia's doorsteps. Thousands of migrants have been stranded along the border for months after being denied entry to the European Union by Poland. Minsk says Warsaw is violating international asylum norms by preventing the migrants from crossing the border and greeting them with a heavy-handed response. In face of escalating military activities near the border, Belarus and Russia held snap joint military drills in the area. Russia's defense ministry confirmed in a statement that its paratroopers were taking part in the exercise. Minsk has also threatened to cut off Russian gas supplies to Europe through pipelines that transit through Belarusian territory in retaliation for any possible sanctions from the EU. It would be bad news for Europe if Belarus moves to carry out the threat, as gas prices on the continent have already hit all-time highs and are vulnerable to any possible supply disruptions.
The United States has decided to bolster its military ties to NATO ally Greece. The military agreement was concluded during the recent visit of the Greek Minister of Foreign Affairs, Nikos Dendias, to Washington. The new agreement will remain in force indefinitely unless one of the parties withdraws. The military agreement will make Greece the U.S. military logistics center in the region.
Greece has been in America's orbit and has enjoyed a strategic partnership with America ever since the end of the Greek Civil War, in which the Greek nationalists triumphed over the Greek communists as a result of the military assistance which America provided to them.
The U.S. will also have increased military presence in the Alexandroupolis, Crete, the Tochoro, and Larissa regions. The renewed agreement gives the U.S. the right to access any Greek military bases and to expand the areas for the U.S. forces to conduct military drills. The U.S. Navy will also be able to go to Bulgaria and Romania without using Turkey's straits. The agreement will significantly reduce the importance of Turkey regarding Black Sea access. Greece has been trying to position itself strategically in the region.
The Americans are encountering some problems with Erdogan. So by America and Greece concluding this extraordinary military deal, it is a way of the Americans placing subtle pressure on Erdogan, not on the Turkish state, but on Erdogan personally.
In recent months, the U.S. has sent heavy military equipment to the Balkans and European countries through the port of Alexandroupolis, with plans for further military shipments in November. Back in November 2020, Greece submitted a request to the U.S. Department of Defense to purchase F-35 fighter jets. The proposal was welcomed by the U.S. In other words, it would not be surprising if the F-35s, which were not given to Turkey, were given to the neighboring countries soon. The military cooperation between the U.S. and Greece comes amid a row between Ankara and Athens. Greece and Turkey are both NATO members, but they are at loggerheads over a number of issues. Back in 2020, Turkey dispatched Oryx Reis and warships escorting it to survey an area between Cyprus and the Greek island of Crete in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. The mission was meant to explore oil and natural gas in that region. That led to an escalation of tensions, with the two NATO allies launching air and naval drills of their own in the waters.
The major reason behind this agreement, this military agreement between Washington and Athens, is a result of America having gathered some of its allies from the Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Middle East in an Eastern Mediterranean partnership. Now, what am I referring to? Well, I'm referring to the reserves of oil and gas which have been found adjacent to Cyprus.
Greece has also accused Turkey of acting like a pirate state in the Aegean Sea in regards to migrants. Athens has called on the EU to put pressure on Ankara to meet its international obligations. Athens frequently blames Ankara for failing to crack down on smugglers who send out migrants in unsafe boats from its shores in breach of a 2016 accord with the European Union. Under the accord, Turkey was to reduce the flow of migrants through its territory to EU countries, such as Greece, return for billions in financial aid.
Well, of course, Turkey is a dangerously expansionist country. After all, Turkey illegally occupies the north of Cyprus. Turkey illegally occupies the northwest of Syria. However, there is very little chance of a conflict between Turkey and Greece. Why? Because both countries are in NATO and both countries enjoy a strategic partnership with America.
It is believed Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is using the migrant issue to put more pressure on the European Union. The military cooperation between Greece and the U.S. would give Athens a greater leverage in its confrontation with Turkey. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has not made it a secret in the aspirations that it has to have influence in the entire West Asia region and beyond.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Allahumma inni ataqarrabu ilayka bidhikrik wa astashfi'u bika ila nafsik wa as'aluka bijudika an tudniyani min qurbik wa an tuzi'ani shukrak wa an tulhimani dhikrak. Allahumma inni as'aluka su'ala khadi'in mutadhallilin khashi' an tusamihani wa tarhamani wa taj'alani biqismika radiyan qani'a.
In this part of the supplication and in these divine phrases, the commander of the believers, Imam Ali alayhi salam, is asking three positions from his Lord. As'aluka bijudika an tudniyani min qurbik, I ask you through your munificence to bring me nearer to your mercy, which was the station of nearness. Wa an tuzi'ani shukrak, and to bless me with gratitude to you, which is the position of gratitude. Wa an tulhimani dhikrak, and to inspire me with your remembrance, the position of remembrance. We have sufficiently discussed the position of nearness, and we are to discuss the gratitude position. These are the positions that Almighty Allah's favorite servants gained, the gratitude positions, only due to their vigorous attempts. It is so high a position that only a few can obtain it. This is what the Holy Quran says, وَقَلِيلٌ مِّنْ عِبَادِيَ الشَّكُورُ, but few of my servants are grateful. The valuable narrator, the late Mullah Muhammad al-Baqir Majlisi, says about this gratitude position, الشُكْرُ الْإِعْتِرَافُ بِالنِّعْمَةِ ظَاهِرًا وَبَاطِنًا. Gratitude is acknowledging the blessings, وَمَعْرِفَةُ الْمُنْعِمِ وَصَرْفُهَا فِيمَا أَمَرَ بِهِ, and the provider of the blessings, and spending our blessings in ways we are ordered. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has stated, شُكْرُ النِّعْمَةِ اِجْتِنَابُ الْمَحَارِمِ, being grateful of Almighty Allah's blessings is avoiding all that is unlawful. So this is one aspect of being grateful. At the end of his sermon on Ashura night, Imam Hussein alayhi salam asked the Almighty, فَجْعَلْنَا مِنَ الشَّاكِرِينَ, O Lord, set us as your grateful servants, which means that this is a very high position and station. Regarding this word gratitude, Raghib Isfahani says, gratitude has three levels, hearty, verbal, and practical. Hearty gratitude is just knowing the blessings as well as the provider of the blessings. Verbal gratitude is confessing to the blessings, and the practical gratitude is consuming the blessings in the ways which Almighty Allah, the creator of all of us, has ordered.
Oh Allah, I seek to draw myself nearer to you through your invocation, and I pray to you to intercede on my behalf, and I beg you by your benevolence to draw me nearer to you and grant thankfulness towards you and inspire me to remember and to invoke you. Oh Allah, I ask you begging submissively, humbly and awe-strickenly, to treat me with clemency and mercy, and to make me pleased and content with what you have granted me, and cause me to be modest and unassuming in all circumstances. Oh Allah, I beg as one whose neediness is extreme, and who supplicates his knees to you, and whose desire for that which is with you has become great. Oh Allah, great is your kingdom, and exalted is your greatness. Your plan is secret, your authority is manifest, your might is victorious and subduing, and your power is prevalent throughout, and it is not possible to escape from your dominion. O Allah, apart from you, I do not find anyone able to pardon my sins, nor to conceal my shameful acts, nor do I have anyone except you to change my evil deeds into virtues.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has narrated this tradition. Inna Allah Azza wa Jal awha ila Musa, Ya Musa, ushkurni haqqa shukri. The Almighty revealed to Moses, O Moses, be grateful to me as I deserve it. فَقَالَ يَا رَبِّ وَكَيْفَ أَشْكُرُكَ حَقَّ شُكْرِكَ وَلَيْسَ مِنْ شُكْرٍ إِلَّا وَأَنْتَ أَنْعَمْتَ عَلَيْهِ. Very interesting, Moses says. He says, O God, O Lord, how should I be grateful to you as you deserve it, while I thank you for your blessings by my tongue that is another blessing of you? The Almighty Allah says, Ya Musa, الآن شكرتني حَيْثُ عَلِمْتَ أَنَّ ذَلِكَ مِنِّي. O Moses, you are grateful now, as you understood that even your tongue is my blessing. This is what the true servants of the Almighty Allah consider. This is the true recognition of those servants. That's why we read in Arafah's application of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, وَلَوْ حَرَصْتُ أَنَا وَالْعَادُّونَ مِنْ أَنَامِكَ أَنْ نُحْسِيَ مَدَى إِنْعَامِكَ سَالِفِهِ وَآنِفِهِ مَا حَصَرْنَاهُ عَدَدًا وَلَا أَحْسَيْنَاهُ عَدَدًا. If I crave for more, taken up with greed to have an idea about the bounties of you, given and to be given with the help of the expert accountants, we shall neither be able to fence in the sum total, nor reckon, nor agree with each other, also from where and how all that was made available to us. This is one aspect and one definition of the gratitude position. We'll talk about this position more in the next programs, God willing. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Pomegranate has a special place in Iranian culture. There is a trace of the fruit everywhere from poetry to cooking. Iranians even hold a pomegranate festival in the fall. This year the event is held in one of the main parks in the capital, Tehran. The festival features different varieties of pomegranates that are grown across Iran. The visitors can also find pomegranate products, including juices, concentrates, and dressings. The event includes cultural parades, music concerts, and traditional live performances. Iranians say they always welcome the pomegranate season, as it's one of the old symbols in the country's literature and art. The Christmas season always brings happiness and joy to people around the world. Many Parisians these days are taking a respite from their daily routines and hitting famous departmental stores now light up with present boxes. Cheerful families could be spotted at Christmas-decorated galleries, Lafayette and Printemps department stores. Automated figures and colorful window displays are the center of attractions for them and their children. It's a season when people buy Christmas gifts for their loved ones and stores make big profits this time around. Many Parisians say they want to take advantage of this period as the government is debating whether or not to impose a COVID-related lockdown. In Venezuela, a large number of musicians are striving for one common goal, and that's setting the Guinness record as the world's largest orchestra. Over 12,000 musicians, mostly children and adolescents, have played together to make that happen. Hundreds of violins, violas, and double basses playing in unison at this setting in Caracas. The musicians are all connected to the country's network of youth orchestras. For them to set a record, over 8,000 instruments had to play at the same time during a 5-minute period of a classical piece. Right now, a Russian orchestra that played the country's national anthem is holding the record. Once done, the crowd of musicians erupted in cheers, lifting their instruments and waving Venezuelan flags. Guinness will announce its decision in the next 10 days. tourists and residents in Los Angeles have been mesmerized by a dazzling new event the U.S. city is hosting, with holiday-themed and full of colorful lights. Visitors can enjoy a mile-long walkway covered on all sides with brightly lit installations. Artists from around the world have taken part in the exhibition. The centerpiece display is a cathedral tunnel lit with thousands of bulbs. Another amazing attraction is the orbs, lit up with thousands of torches. The event has been a huge hit with the LA public.
Oh my gosh, it's so nice.
And it gets to be out in the open, and it's like a perfect night to do it, so it's great.
It's definitely the best. Like, we had to do, like, in a car to go see lights, and then we got to, like, now, like, go around and actually walk and get to see everything up close, which is super nice.
Yeah.
Definitely after the, what, year and a half that we've had. Yeah. So.
And it's really nice to see everything up close, because it's like, you see in a photo, but then it's more real and real, so.
Yeah.
The event opened to the public on the 12th of November and will run for 5 nights. Preparations for the event, however, started a month ago. The organizers say millions of bulbs and 17 miles of cables are used for the 18 art installations.
Paleontologists in Brazil have discovered remains that could belong to a species of dinosaur as yet unknown. The fossils were found at a site in northeastern Brazil. A team of scientists is trying to put together the bones and complete the huge dinosaur's skeleton. They think it lived during the Cretaceous period, which began around 145 million years ago and ended with extinction of all dinosaurs roughly 66 million years ago. From a gray and gloomy look to a cheery and colorful appearance. That's a story of how a neighborhood in Peru's capital, Lima, is being transformed to become a tourist attraction. A group of artists in Lima are bringing color and joy to this hilly neighborhood by painting the walls of houses. Creating an optical illusion of a giant mural, the project is visible from different spots across the city. The designers are hoping what they did can improve the lives of residents in a neighborhood that was considered to be unsafe before.
What we are doing here is communal work with all the neighbors, and we are doing it because it's important to change the environment through the use of colors. This hill was considered an unsafe and dangerous area of the city, so we decided to change that social stigma through art, which, for me as a muralist, is the best tool to achieve it.
The project was started 5 months ago, and workers are now putting the final touches to their work of art. The mural covers over 300,000 square meters. It's the largest in South America.
The birth of a baby sloth at an uncharacteristically hasty speed has surprised London zookeepers. A tiny two-toed sloth named Terry was born to a mother, Marilyn, at the weekend. The zookeepers say there was no sign at all that Marilyn was going into labor when they checked her in the morning. However, less than an hour, they spotted something like a tiny arm tucked into her tummy. Marilyn had quietly delivered the baby with no fuss at all while her keepers were chopping up sweet potatoes for her breakfast. The mother and baby are said to be doing well, but the zookeepers still don't know the sex of the baby.
Modern technology has changed our lives in countless ways, with robots now preparing to lend a hand in operation rooms. Surgical robots are on display at the 4th China International Import Expo. One of the machines, dubbed Mesa X, gives assistance in spinal surgery. Employing the robot can lessen bleeding by 50% compared to open surgeries. Another one assists doctors to perform interventional surgeries.
Guide valves in the vessels can be controlled even less than 1 millimeter.
This is not cannot be achieved by the human hands. With the great, I think, market impact from this showcase, we successfully performed a first case PCI in Hainan Boao on March 13th.
The producers say surgical robots will soon operate in more hospitals around China. Therefore, training centers have been established to help surgeons learn how to operate the new generation of surgical robots.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A tigress belonging to the endangered Bengal species has given birth to four cubs at the Mexican Zoo, bringing joy and hope to wildlife enthusiasts. The four were born in the San Jorge Park in the city of Ciudad Juarez on October 10th. Nearly a month on, they are in good health. That is good news, because usually when multiple cubs are born, not all of them survive. Zoo officials have not yet determined the sex of the newborn cubs. That is because their mother lets out a roar when the vets are nearby. Bengal tigers are endangered for two reasons: poaching and the destruction of their natural habitat. Here's what you can call killing two birds with one stone. Classic car lovers have gone on an exciting rally to see an erupting volcano. The event, organized by Beshbuk Rallies, happened on a Saturday. Motorists taking part in the vintage rally had the unique opportunity to witness a volcano erupting ash and smoke. Most of the participants tried to get as close as they could to the volcano, but there were also those who chose to take other vehicles because they were afraid that their precious antique cars would be damaged.
Workers digging gas pipes in the Peruvian capital Lima have discovered a cemetery dating back two millennia. Archaeologists have recovered six bodies, including those of children. All of them were buried in a seated position. The site also yielded about 40 burial vessels. The findings are thought to belong to the culture known as White on Red, which settled on the central coast of Peru centuries ago during the pre-Hispanic era.
Often it does not take much to bring about positive social change. In Johannesburg, a group of painters are creating artworks on the trolleys of street recyclers. Reason? To encourage bystanders to look up and notice the work recyclers, locally known as reclaimers, do in the community.
I like my work to have meaning, so when I get to paint and become a part of a project like this, it's great for me, you know? Because it's not every day we get to do stuff like this, so yeah.
Up until now, they were just filthy-looking jumbo bags with recyclable waste wheeling along the streets. But thanks to graffiti artists who are giving them a makeover with bold and bright designs to help identify and protect recyclers, artists say their goal is to build a relationship between neighborhood residents and waste pickers. The reclaimers roam around the city day and night, with some motorists even considering them a risk, as the trolleys are not always visible. There are some 6,000 reclaimers in Johannesburg who make a living collecting, sorting, recycling garbage. It's a messy job, but they do it anyway. A group of women are joining hands to protect one of India's key natural sites that is also on UNESCO's heritage list, the Western Ghats. a mountain chain that's facing severe deforestation. The 27 members of this all-female task force are doing all they can to protect the area's rare ferns, mosses, and thousands of other plants. They're using a variety of gardening tools and techniques to preserve species from all over the mountains. Not only that, but they also make artificial conditions and habitats for endangered species from other parts of the world, mainly those affected by climate change. One of the conservationists explained that what they are doing is actually helping the forest regenerate.
We have witnessed the birth of a forest, and that's a very powerful thing. You know, the mind is filled with the ghastly stories of forests being cut, like the Amazon or like the Western Ghats, but here we're witness to the birth of forests as well, and that is the forest itself birthing itself, you see.
The Western Ghats Mountains are home to nearly 5,000 species of flowering plants, but many of them are globally threatened. Only less than half of the area's flora is currently under conservation. Scientists say the outlook for the mountain is very concerning. Carbon dioxide is one of the causes of global warming, but can we get rid of it to save our planet? A Swiss firm has come up with a novel idea to store CO2 underground and turn it into rocks. Company Climeworks has started operating the world's largest direct air carbon capture and storage plant called Okra in Iceland, located in Hershey. Okra is entirely run on renewable energy. It soaks carbon dioxide directly from the air and buries it as rocks deep underground to be mineralized. Usually, a natural process takes hundreds of thousands of years to turn the gas into basaltic rocks, but here it takes up to 2 years for the CO2 to turn into white crystals.
Once the carbon dioxide is captured, it will be dissolved in water, and here we are at the injection site. The carbon dioxide dissolved in water will come through this pipe into the well, where it will be injected into the volcanic rock at a depth of between 800 meters and 2 kilometers.
The plant is said to be removing 4,000 tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere each year. The amount is too little to save the planet from carbon emissions, as climate modeling suggests the world needs to eliminate several billion tons per year by 2050. Here we have to take into account the saying of the head of Orca that we have to learn to walk before we can run. Legends never die. So 1 year after his death, Argentinians are remembering their hero on his birthday. And that's no one but that legendary football player, Diego Maradona. It would have been Maradona's 61st birthday this year. People all around the country, including in the capital, Buenos Aires, remembered their iconic figure in ceremonies over the weekend. In the city of Rosario, a giant monument was inaugurated in honor of the football star. You can see on your screens fans gathering there in celebration. They say Maradona's love still runs in the veins of Argentinians.
IRIB English Radio.